How can you be a successful entrepreneur without a creative idea? Welcome to Venture Voice, show number 21. I'm your host, Greg Gallant. Today our guest is Fabrice Grinda. Had I interviewed Fabrice a couple days earlier, I could say he's the CEO of Zingy, a company that sells ringtones and other media for cell phones. Fabrice started and sold Zingy for $80 million, and it now has over 130 employees and generates over $130 million in yearly content sales. But I can't say he's CEO anymore, because I caught up with Fabrice in his Manhattan office just a couple of hours before he was leaving Zingy for good. Now he simply describes himself as a serial entrepreneur. Almost all of his stuff was packed into boxes, but Fabrice didn't seem nostalgic at all. This 31-year-old French native was really excited about setting off for a journey around the world. When you hear how he's built his past several businesses, you'll understand that Fabrice's vacation travel isn't just a break. It's his process for discovering what his next multi-million dollar business idea will be. Enjoy. Well, Fabrice, welcome to Venture Voice.
Thank you.
So why don't you tell me about when you first realized you had the entrepreneurial bug? Was it in college or before or after that?
It took me a while to figure out that it was that I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. It wasn't the first time I became an entrepreneur was just because I noticed an arbitrage opportunity. So when I came to the U.S. for college, I realized that computer prices in Europe were a lot higher.
Now tell me about why you came to the U.S. and where you came from.
So I'm originally French. I was born in Paris, and I grew up in Nice. But as I was considering my college options, I went and interviewed at all the top French universities. And I was interviewing at one of the top schools, and the top professor there asked me, so what do you want to do after college? And I'm like, you know, I don't know, consulting, banking, business. And he looks at me, and he's like, what? You would betray the ideals of the French Socialist Revolution. And I burst out laughing. And then, of course, realized he wasn't laughing. He wasn't kidding. And so I'm like, you know what? U.S., here I come. So applied to a few U.S. colleges. I don't know by what miracle I got in, given that I barely spoke English at the time. Got into Princeton and actually loved it. But when I was at Princeton...
Were you feeling guilty at all for that betrayal?
You know, not really, because I felt that the way the French college system works, the people that leave it, especially in the elitist schools, end up all thinking the same, looking the same, and they go and work for the government. They're part of the bureaucracy. You know, 25% of people in France work for the government. And I didn't want to be part of the problem. I wanted to be part of the solution. And I felt that if I left and did something with my life that was for the better, I wouldn't be betraying France, actually. I'd be showing an example for the other youth in France to see what they could do with their lives.
So to you, this going into business, you viewed that as your contribution to the world. That's a positive.
No, going to business is not a contribution to the world. But when you see that in France, there's 23% unemployment rate. You have a lot of people that I'm not, or for the youth, that is. There's a 9-10% unemployment rate for the country as a whole. A lot of people are not inspired. They're kind of in a morass and they're not sure where the future leads. Whereas if you can come to the U.S. with nothing, and succeed out of nothing, it shows that there is still social mobility in the world. There's the ability to make it. So it's not being in business per se that's inspiring, but the fact that you can go from nothing and make it in this country, that's really inspiring. And the American dream is still well and alive and kicking, despite the fact that social mobility has become a bit harder than it was in the past.
Cool. So now you're inspired, you're in school, and what are you seeing aside from books?
So what happened is I'd been playing with computers, you know, forever. I got my first PC in 1981, and I'd been, you know, following the evolution from 8086, 286, 386, et cetera. So I'd always been in computers, and I was very well aware of computer prices in Europe and in France specifically. And so when I came to the U.S. and I realized that retail prices in the U.S. were lower than wholesale prices in France, created a pretty amazing opportunity to basically buy at wholesale in the U.S. by incorporating a little company and exporting it to distributors or actually retailers in France and bypassing a few levels of profit margin and basically also doing a time arbitrage. Because at the time, companies like Microsoft or Intel were not global yet. You know, they would release in the U.S. a year before they release in Europe. And when they release in Europe, they'd sell to distributors, they'd sell to wholesalers, they'd sell to retailers. So three levels of profit margin, which of course would mean that the end user price would be three times the U.S. price and it would be released a year later. So I created that little company exporting to a few retail stores, and that helped to pay for college. It helped to pay for my living expenses.
What kind of revenue were you able to get out of that? Or profit?
Revenues, I think, first year we did 50,000, then ended up being a couple hundred thousand. I don't remember if it was 300,000 or 400,000. And by the end of the third year, so I did it for 3.5 years. But the issue is, as with most arbitrage opportunities, the very fact of exercising it made it disappear. So the margins divided by five. You know, so the first year and 50,000 in revenues, rather than 25,000 in profits. By the end of the 3.5 year, after I did 400,000 in revenues, but maybe 50,000 in profits because the margins are compressed dramatically. The companies become more global. So I never saw this as a means of, you know, as the future life for me. I just saw it as a cool way to learn business, to learn accounting, to pay for college and to pay for my lifestyle in college.
Wow. So why do you think it was new to the US college kid who figured this out and not one of these companies that figured out, hey, let's just arbitrage this stuff?
It's probably too small an opportunity for a large company to go after. I mean, yeah. I'm talking 500,000 a year in revenues. You know, it's not a $1 billion company. And yeah. So it's something that someone where the opportunity cost of my time was very low, as it is when you're in college, you have nothing better to do, that could afford to do that and not, you know, a large company where they have probably other bigger, better opportunities to succeed or to do.
Cool. So is that what kind of consumed your time in college when you think back to it?
Partly I did that. I was TA in accounting, actually head TA in accounting. So I taught my fellow undergrads as a tutor in math and econ.
I saw you're also summa cum laude.
Summa cum laude. So I studied pretty hard as well. I played in the tennis team for a while. Did a lot of stuff.
It's this kind of myth that entrepreneurs are guys with low grades and attention deficit disorder, I guess, not always true.
It depends on the type of entrepreneur you are. So some entrepreneurs, you know, they have a product vision and they follow that vision to the end and they build products around that vision. And typically these are the entrepreneurs that are not able to scale with a company. They're not necessarily in a position where they're going to take it to a billion. They start the idea and then they hire someone to manage it. So Pierre Meadiar has a great idea, builds the beginning of eBay, and then he brings in Meg Whitman to go and manage it and take it to the next level. I'm not really that kind of entrepreneur because I'm not very creative. So I don't come up with brilliant new ideas, but I'm pretty good once I find an idea that I like and at executing against it and building and growing the company. So I'm much more didactic. I look more on paper, I look more like a businessman than an entrepreneur. Just so happens that I'd rather not work for anyone else. And that's why I'm an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So tell me about, so you graduate college now, what do you decide to do? You've had this entrepreneurial success under your belt. What's next?
We're 1996, and I had feared at the time that I'd missed the boat already on the internet, you know, and that all the great ideas were already being done. And frankly, I didn't have the skill set yet, or I didn't feel I had the skill set to build an amazing company and scale it. I was, you know, a 21-year-old college student. What did I really know of the world and of life? Therefore, like, okay, maybe I'm missing the boat on the internet, you know, and because I was on Usenet, I was on IRC, I was on Gopher, I was on Mosaic, I was on Netscape.
Better, right?
You know, I was everywhere. I knew the products. I saw the web, you know, start in front of my eyes. I knew Yahoo when it was hosted in the Stanford pages. And yet I didn't feel there was something I could do. I didn't have the skill set to grow a company and build it. And so I decided to choose the traditional path, which was, you know, to meet gold banking or consulting. So it's like, okay, do I go to Goldman or do I go to McKinsey? A few friends of mine had gone to McKinsey before. I really liked it. There was an entire McKinsey mystique at the time, at least I felt there was. And so I decided to go to McKinsey & Company in New York. And I worked in the financial institution group or industry group. And I had a blast. I learned really a lot about business per se in the sense that I learned how to analyze and structure ideas, how to analyze markets, how to write business plans, how to better present, how to better orally and in writing. And so it was basically business school or finishing school, except they pay you. And at the same time, that's where I met pretty much most of my best friends. I mean, the people they hire are brilliant people. And everyone I met is like, wow, you know, they've done such amazing things. So it was extremely exciting, extremely interesting. But after 2 years at McKinsey, you know, I realized that my goal in life was not to write the perfect PowerPoint presentation. It's not just writing presentation and hoping for someone to maybe apply it one day. I needed to do something. And, you know, lo and behold, I realized that not everything was done on the internet. And so for 6 months, day and night, I looked for new ideas that I could bring to the world. After 6 months, I'm like, you know what? It doesn't matter. But despite that, I am at the right time. I am at the right place with the right skills. I need to do something on the internet. So if I can't come up with something brilliant and new to do, I'm going to steal someone else's brilliant ideas and take it to places not done before. So if you want to do that, you need to come up with selection criteria for evaluating business ideas. So I came up with my 9 personal business selection criteria, which look a lot like what VCs would look like, except embedded with what are my personal preferences and personal capabilities. Because obviously there's some ideas I'm in a better position to execute against than others. And so I looked at every American idea, you know, Expedia.
So first, can you tell me, don't tell me all the ideas, I mean all the selection criteria, but maybe the two most important and then the third that's just the most personal one.
See, the issue is all nine, to some extent, all nine are required. Yeah. Because if you have some and not the others, I think the idea, there's probably something that's going to be missing in your selection criteria. But I'll give you the...
We'll post them all on the website.
So, they're on the website, at FabriceGrinder.com, which is my blog. But maybe what's more important, I'll give you an example of one that's just market-driven and one that's personal. So the one that's market-driven would be, I like an idea where the business model is known from the get-go. So from the get-go, I know how much I'm going to charge, who I'm going to charge, what the gross margin is, and what the net margin is. And if you start a startup today, there's maybe a 5% chance you'll still be alive in 5 years. But if you start without a business model, it's probably 0.1% chance you'll be around. It doesn't sound like a lot of difference, but I'd rather have that times 50 factor working in my favor. Now, there are a few counterexamples to that, and I realize that Google is a counterexample to that. But frankly, you know, they got lucky. And there's hundreds of other businesses that started without business models like Pets.com, which are not around. And so I'd rather start with someone I know and I understand from the get-go. One that's more personal would be, you know, I want to do an idea that I like, you know, for instance, or an idea that I know how to execute against. And so that means that for me, biotech is partly excluded because, you know, five teams of scientists presented me the great cure for prostate cancer. I'm going to be able to tell you which of the teams has the best PowerPoint presentations, which one presents the best, which ones, you know, dress the best. But I'm not going to be able to tell you which of the scientific approach they're using is going to be the best at solving the problem. And therefore, I'm not the best for running that company. Whereas, because I know how to program, because I've worked in technology and with programmers for many years, I have somewhat of a comparative advantage in leading technology teams, and I feel a lot more comfortable in the internet. So that's examples of two different ideas.
So it gave you that structure when you were looking at the infinite number of ideas out there.
Yeah, so I looked at Expedia, Priceline, Yahoo, Amazon, Netflix, Smash.com, Free Markets, and chose eBay. And I chose eBay, it was about June 15, 1998. So it was about a week before they filed their S1, which was pretty good because their S1 became the basis for my business plan. I sold my apartment, I sold all the stock, and I'd been not so lucky, but I bought four stocks in 1996, which were Microsoft, Intel, Yahoo, and Amazon. So in 98, they'd done not amazing, but then pretty good.
I sold diversified them. Portfolio, right?
Yeah, slightly concentrated, but at least I knew that industry more than others. Yeah. Sold everything and moved to France, moved back to Paris, and created, which was the eBay of France, Italy, Spain, and the Nordic countries. And then a year later, created Deremate, which is the eBay of Latin America. Raised a whole bunch of money, you know, grew it to 400 people in 15 countries and had an amazing blast, basically growing the company. And late 2000, sold both companies and then started looking for what to do next. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, tell me real quick, when you grew those companies, so that was your first real business on your own, or your first business of that scale. What do you think made you successful? I mean, a lot of people are dabbling in these type of ideas.
Most of the people that started businesses in Europe were not going at it with a very business-oriented approach. So a lot of auction sites were created in France and Italy and Spain, but none of them really figured out what the key success factors were. I'm like, okay, if you're running an auction site, what matters? Well, it's liquidity. So you need buyers and you need sellers. And if you once you get the engine started, you have ever more buyers that attract ever more sellers and ever more sellers that attract ever more buyers, and you end up with essentially a natural monopoly. As the, you can only sell the items in one place, you're probably going to want to sell them in the places where they're more likely to sell. That's why eBay is essentially today in the current position of structure indisplaceable in the US. There's no other place to sell at an auction because it's going to sell on eBay. It's not going to sell anywhere else. And so a lot of these sites just put the site up and that was it. I'm like, okay, let's be proactive. How did eBay go about structuring themselves? So we built a team for in each country where there was, country manager, and below the country manager, we had a VP of marketing and online and offline marketing team. We had a VP of sales and a sales team organized by category. So we had a category manager for coins, a category manager for computer goods, a category manager for stamps, etc. We would go to all the fairs. We'd actually proactively approach all the potential power sellers, so the people that are most likely to have the most items, and help them list them on the site. So the day we launched, we already had tens of thousands of items where all of our competitors and most had a few thousand. And then in order to get the buyers, were extremely proactive from a PR perspective. I mean, it's incredible how unsavvy a lot of the French entrepreneurs were with regards to PR. You know, they would, if a journalist contacted them, they considered it a waste of time to talk to the journalist, as opposed to actually, you know, let's organize a, let's do a full press tour, let's do a press release, let's at the press conference invite all the journalists, let's go on, you know, 300 interviews. So we built a full PR campaign around our company, explaining who we were, where we were, and frankly, the image of a new product, of someone youthful, entrepreneurial, succeeding, was extremely appealing to the French market from a PR perspective. And at the same time, we spent a fair amount of money in advertising getting the buyers. And so by committing to the sellers that we would spend money in advertising to get them visibility and buyers, it started getting the liquidity engine going. And
but now that's a lot of infrastructure you had to invest in before revenue. Where do you get that financing?
What happened is in 96, when I graduated from Princeton, I was left with about 50K after Princeton, after paying for everything. 25K, I put a down payment in a one-bedroom apartment, which is, believe it or not, you could buy a one-bedroom apartment in New York in 96 for $105,000. But 25K was a down payment, the rest was debt. The other 25K I put in these four stocks. Comes to 98, when I decide I sell the apartment for 185, so there's a pretty big profit there. I sell the four stock for around 300,000. So after taxes, I was left with 350,000.
Which one made more, by the way, the stocks or the apartment?
The apartment, because it was my primary residence, was tax-free. And whereas the stocks were not. So they basically made pretty much the same. One was using leverage, the other wasn't. But on ROI basis, it ended up being the same return. And so in both cases, I ended up yielding, you know, 175 each. So that was 350, which was the seed money. And I invested every last penny. That was the seed money for Auckland. And it got tough at times. I mean, there were times where I was wondering how we were going to make payroll the next month. But then I started raising money, you know, 50K here, 50K there, and to patch it all together. And then once the engine started rolling, we started getting press, we started buyers and sellers, we started getting approached by every VC in the planet. So we didn't really have that much revenues yet, but I'd written a pretty good business plan. And these were the times where on youth, and a decent resume, you know, Princeton, McKinsey, you know, summa cum laude, you could actually raise a lot of money. So yes, I was 23 or 24, but total, we probably raised over $120 million in venture capital money.
Wow. And how much of the company did you give up for that?
A lot. I mean, and I didn't raise it all at once. And what happened is I ended up in the European entity, we gave up over 50%. And in the Latin American entity, also over 66%. But it didn't matter. I mean, I felt that it's better to have 10% of a billion than, you know, 100% of nothing.
Yeah.
And so, and the issue is, it's not that I wanted to raise that much money, but we were in a very competitive environment where all of our competitors were basically raising money and advertising and in a winner-take-all market. So we needed to be the winner. Otherwise, you know, we'd be nowhere, no one in the market. And so it wasn't by choice. It was really, we didn't have a choice. Everyone else was doing it. And if we didn't do it, we're not going to exist. And so I raised money and diluted ourselves more than we wanted to, spent more money, frankly, in advertising than we wanted to. But again, if we had not done it, it's unclear the company would still be around today. And yet today it is around. It's profitable, and both of them profitable and doing well. And that's why, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing that we did all that.
Yeah, so how much? And then, so you did all that, you raised the money, and then you went and you decided to sell it once it got started?
We got approached by eBay, but my majority shareholder didn't want to sell to eBay. So we ended up selling to another European entity called QXL Ricardo, which was a publicly listed or traded auction site on the London Stock Exchange. So we merged Auckland with QXL Ricardo, and we sold the Latin American entity, Deremate, to Terra Lycos. And that was it.
So how much did you sell it for to each one of those?
It was a complex transaction. The Deremate deal, I think it was partly capital raise and partly sell. I think it was 170 million valuation. And the QXL Ricardo deal was, I don't remember the valuation. It was extremely high, but it was an all stock deal.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the stock promptly crashed, you know, 99%+. So. And when all that entire story ended after all the stocks crashed, because Terra Lycos stock crashed and the QXL Ricardo stock crash, ended up making, you know, $700,000. So the ROI on my investment wasn't all that high.
I saw
right?
all this and you got $700,000 off of a, you know, $100 million venture.
Yeah. And I mean, for a few minutes, I was worth, you know, a couple hundred million.
What did you do for those few minutes?
Well, when both companies were sold and I had stock, I was locked up. And I could see the stock drop every day. So for 6 months, or actually I was locked up for a year, I could see the value of my stock go from, you know, 400 million and 300 million. And there's nothing I could do. I mean, the interesting value of the company is not, or the value in the stock market is not necessarily based with what I was doing on the operations. Yeah. And so at the end of the day, when I left, I had $700,000. So when you think about it, you know, I could have probably put the $300,000 from the apartment and the socks and left in the stock market and the real estate, probably done just as well, if not better, right? That one-bedroom apartment today is probably worth $400K.
Yeah. Yeah, at least.
But I learned a lot. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes. I'd made five big mistakes in that first company. First, I'd given too much of the company to my co-founder. And what I realized, even though I founded...
How much did you give to the co-founder?
I gave him essentially, it did 50-50 with me. Even though, and he was the CTO and I was the CEO. But I found him, I found the idea, et cetera. And the issue, the problem was not the dilution. The problem he then felt entitled to make decisions. The problem, companies are not democracies. It's good to get everyone's opinions, but at the end of the day, it's a dictatorship. One person needs to make a decision. And if it takes you longer to make it, too long to make a decision, in a rapidly moving environment, it's very dangerous. I mean, on the internet and mobile media and all rapidly changing environments, I feel that it's often better to make the wrong decision and maybe fix it over time as you realize you made the wrong decision than making no decision at all. And so that was one issue. Second issue is we were listening to all the VCs, and at the time, eBay was crashing all the time. And so all the VCs were like, you need to prove to us you can build a scalable system. So it took us 9 months to build the first version of the site. And we built a very scalable system, but in the meantime, 50 competitors launched. That was a mistake. We should have launched immediately with a crappy site. We didn't need the best technology, et cetera, and scaled it over time. Because being in the market, being in the minds and ears of consumers, and getting mind share is very critical.
Even if it means your site goes down for a day and a few people have bad experiences?
So what? We're not selling, you know, it's not as though if the site goes down there, people are going to die. You know, it means the item didn't go on sale at the right time or they didn't get their last bid. Big deal. You know, it's like when we launched Zingy, didn't do that. We were crashing every time we had too much traffic. It didn't matter. We're selling ringtones. You know, it depends which business you're in. You know, if you're in mission critical business, yes, you want to do 99.99999 uptime. Not in this business, especially at the very beginning when you're only getting really early adopters. Third issue is all of our competitors were free, but all the VCs said, no, we want you to have a business model that's in place from the get-go. And I knew how much I wanted to charge to the consumers, but they made me charge to the consumers from the get-go. And as a result, it took us forever to convince consumers it was worth paying for it when all the competitors were free. So I'm not saying you should be free and free forever. I'm saying maybe we should have been free for a limited time period, saying, hey, we're free for a year, we're free for 2 years, but eventually we're going to charge once people got comfortable with the model. Because you need to realize that when I went to France to tell people we're going to do online auctions, the resistance was huge. You know, people were telling me, internet's never going to work in France. We have Minitel. We don't need internet. Ooh, and by the way, it's only these crazy Americans, you know, that trade Beanie Babies on eBay. We French people, you know, we are much more sophisticated. We would never trade these crazy collectibles on online auction sites. And by the way, these Americans, you know, they have garage sales. They really care about these used good culture. We have none of that in France. It's never going to work. Moreover, even if all this wasn't true and it did end up working, we would never put our credit card online. And so with all that resistance, it would have been good actually to be free to get seed the market. So there are two ways to get 1 million users. One is spend $18 million in TV advertising and online advertising. The other one is give something valuable away for free. You know, and that costs you a couple $100,000, maybe an opportunity cost, and then you start charging for it. As long as you set the expectation that you're going to be charging for it. And if you're free, if you tell people you're free forever and then you start charging, that's a huge issue because the people you attracted are probably not people that are going to be willing to pay. The fourth mistake I did was frankly to raise money from the wrong VC. Or the wrong investor, because I ended up raising in France money not from a VC, but from an investor. So these American...
An angel investor, like a wealthy individual? Or?
France's richest guy, called Bernard Arnault. He's worth $18 billion. He's the owner of LVMH. So his team offered... So I met his team, and I frankly didn't really like him, didn't really like his team, because they were arrogant. They didn't understand my business. I didn't think they could be really helpful. And then I had all these American VCs offering money. And I was hesitating. But, you know, one day Arnaud calls me in his office, you know, when the richest guy in France worth $18 billion calls you in his cell phone and invites you to his office, you typically go. I walk in the office and he looks at me and he says, Mr. Grinda, you have a unique opportunity to create the eBay of the rest of the world. We are going to give you the human, financial, and industrial resources necessary to guarantee your success. and to prove to you our commitment and the fact that you're a very strategic investment for us, we will give you twice the valuation and twice the money than anyone else has offered you. You know, so that night I go home and I'm like, okay, you know, let's do my little matrix. Okay, American VCs. Okay, I like them. They understand my business, but they're in the U.S. They're far away. The valuation is a lot lower. Maybe it doesn't necessarily make sense. I hate Arno and his team, so the cultural fit is not there, but they're in Europe, so presumably they're in a better position to help me, and it's a lot more money. So I'm going to be able to expand faster and execute. So I chose him as an investor. What I didn't realize was that our interests were not going to be aligned, because an American VC, or a VC in general, they want to make money. So as long as you make money for them, they're happy. You know, a guy's worth $18 billion. He doesn't really care about making another $100 or $200 million. I'm not even sure he cares about making another $2 billion. So what makes him happy, what makes him tick might be very different. And as a result, our interests were not aligned. And I didn't realize that. And then not only did I not realize that, I didn't necessarily protect against that in my shareholder agreement. So my shareholder agreement had everything. I had tagging along rights, piggyback rights, registration rights, except the right of force of sale if the right offer came along. And when eBay came and offered to buy us for cash, he didn't want to sell because he owned 10% of QXL Ricardo, the company I ended up selling to, and he didn't want to sell to eBay. And so I couldn't force it, unfortunately. And so I realized at that time that our interests were very different. And so he ended up doing the sale to QXL, but that's not at all what I wanted to do, because QXL was more of a on-sale or UBID, a B2C site taking inventory, than eBay, which is a consumer-to-consumer site, or small business-to-consumer site, which is a lot closer to what Auckland was. So I learned a lot, you know, from that period, and decided to take those learnings with me to the next business.
Great. So tell me about a couple of lessons, and then tell me how you came on to Zingy.
Well, I mean, the lessons were those, essentially. You know, these are the mistakes that I made and that I'm not going to do again, right? Because, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So I leave both companies in October 2000, started looking for what to do next. I'm like, you know, being an entrepreneur is really what I want to do. I love building businesses. I love seeing a company grow from nothing and influencing the lives of my employees and seeing them grow with the company and delivering a product that people love. And such, I had to become an entrepreneur again. So I went to my shelf, you know, good, my 9 business selection criteria again. Like, it worked once, could work again. And after all, you know, eBay was the right idea for various reasons, didn't have the proper exit, but it was the right idea. And we executed fairly well against it. And so started looking for the next idea. Considered doing or bringing Match.com to Europe for a while. Ended up not doing it, frankly, for the wrong reason. I listened to consumers, and all the consumers telling me, bad idea. Well, we would never want to be cut dead on this. It's only these crazy Americans. You know, we French people are Europeans. We are romantic about love, you know, and it's only for losers and geeks. And of course, 2 years later, they're all on dating sites. So a really good friend of mine actually ended up creating Meetic, which is the largest dating site in Europe now and went public a month ago, 500 million market cap, doing incredible. So the idea that I probably could have done and or should have done that I didn't do. Consider bringing Netflix to Europe for a while, and I'm like, you know, at the end of the day, I don't want to be beholden to the studios, and, you know, VOD or video on demand might kill the business. So not necessarily an idea I want to be in. Now, friends of mine had created Alando in Germany, the Somewhere Brothers. They sold it to eBay, and that became eBay Germany. So my previous company was not in Germany, so we'd essentially split Europe in two. And they then created a company called Jamba. So I went to visit them in Berlin in late 2000, early 2001 to see what Jamba's up to. And Jamba was basically a mobile media company selling ringtones, wallpapers, and games to the German cell phone market. And they were getting early traction, and it seemed pretty cool and interesting. Another friend of mine created a company in France called Kiwi, doing the exact same thing. And again, actually, the first time I met him, I told him it was a bad idea. Ringtones were worthless. No one was ever going to pay for them. Crap market. And he was wasting his money. You know, but 6 months later, he's doing 18 million revenues and a million in profits. So I'm like, you know, maybe I'm wrong. There's something that ringtone idea in the mobile media market after all. Started looking at the Asian markets and saw how big they were becoming. So I came to the U.S. in early 2001 and realized we were in the dark ages in mobile. There was no SMS interop, so you could not send a text message from one carrier to another. SMS was not part of most of the phone plans. There was no carrier billing systems were closed. Teenagers didn't have cell phones. Prepaid was not a part of the market. Media companies were not licensing content for the mobile. I mean, you name it. Any basis for that market was missing. But as a result, it meant that the market was essentially wide open. There were no competitors or no real big competitors that were established. VCs were saying, you know, B2C telecom, I'll never fund it. And therefore, I thought it would be a unique opportunity to be an early mover in the market. So created Zingy in July 2, 2001, with the objective of creating the largest mobile media company in the Americas. So the objective was become the mobile media destination for carriers, consumers, and media companies. So basically, the role would be go and license content from content owners, publishers, studios, artists, labels, package it for wireless, you know, format it for all the different devices, connect to the carrier's billing systems, connect to the carrier's delivery systems, and then sell it. Sell it to consumers, sell it to media companies, sell it to carriers. Looked at the market and decided there were four different product areas we wanted to be in the long run. There's personalization, so means of expressing your identity. Ringtones, wallpapers, ringback tones. There's entertainment, so games, full-track music downloads, video. There's information services, weather, traffic, stock, quotes, maps, etc. And there's community, chatting, dating, blogging, and floating. And across these, there's search and advertising. So I slice and dice the market, and I'm like, around the world, the first market to take off is ringtones. And the reason that is the first phones that are out, they're black and white, there's no Java, there's no Brew, but enough of them support ringtones that you could build a business out of it. So started Zingy with ringtones in 2001, and little by little grew the business, became the mobile media partner to MSN, to AOL, to MTV, and then all two other carriers. You know, then we started with Sprint, Nextel, AT&T, and ended up signing all the major carriers in the U.S. and then Latin America and in Canada, and grew the business. The company grew from, you know, zero in sales in 2001 to this year, we're probably going to do over 120, 130 million in product sales. The company grew from zero, you know, three employees in 2001 to 130 employees right now. So it's been a huge success, but even then it got close. The company did not get VC funded because it's completely impossible to raise any money in B2C telecom in 2001, 2002. I invested every last penny I had from the previous company. I didn't mean to. We raised, at the very beginning, I raised $1.4 million from a bunch of friends in Europe that had made some money in during the dot-com boom. And like, yeah, you know, mobile media is taking off in Europe. Let's put money in your company. And I actually didn't even raise it all at once. I raised 100K, then 100K, then 50K, et cetera. But then after the 1.4 was in, it was kind of hard to get any more money because they weren't really seeing the traction. You know, we're in late 2002, early 2003, and still losing 100K a month. And so at the end of the month, when payroll came due every month, the easiest place to find money was my checking account. You know, and 50K by 50K or 100K by 100K, when your burn is 100K, 700K doesn't last that long. And then you reach, you know, January 2003, and my 700K was zero. Okay, so I borrow 100,000 of my credit cards. Reach February 2003, and now I'm at negative 100K, and I have no more money. In fact, I have negative 100 money. So we missed payroll. Wow. We missed payroll.
What was that moment like for you?
It was tough. You know, I kept making silly excuses to employees. It wasn't the first time I'd missed payroll, by the way, because sometimes I was in the process of raising 50K from some investor and he sent it only 3 days later. So every time like, ooh, the bank messed up, somehow the payroll didn't get processed. And so they'd heard it before.
They knew what it really meant.
I think some did, but most probably didn't because eventually it always got paid. Yeah. So you missed payroll. And then we missed payroll for like 2 months. It started getting a bit dicey. And we raised a little bit more money, you know, and got okay.
So as you say, if you were writing like the entrepreneur's handbook and you know, you're writing that chapter, what to do if you don't have money for payroll? Is that still your answer?
Oh, well, but...
Little fib or...
No, the reason I did that, by the way, the reason I went 120% is because I actually thought we were going to succeed. By then, I think I had sown the seeds of the success. I'd already signed a deal with MSN. I'd signed a deal with Motorola. I'd signed a deal with Sprint. I'd signed a deal with AT&T. They were not executed on in some cases. And in some cases, I didn't even know how much revenues were going to be generated by it. But I felt that we were getting traction.
How do you do that? I mean, these are old, stodgy companies. These aren't cool guys.
Well, it takes forever, right? So the company was created July 2, 2001. I didn't do the, so the five mistakes I'd done the previous time, I didn't do. So I kept almost all the stock, obviously 20% of the employees, but I didn't do 50-50 with anyone. We launched the site September 5, 2001. So 2 months and 3 days after the creation of the company, we were live. And it was a pretty bad site. It didn't support many phones, didn't have many features, and as soon as traffic got too heavy, it died. But it didn't matter. We were free for 1 year. We were free for 1 year, and while we were free, we built a user base of 1 million users. And so for 10 months, we were free. In July 2002, when we had 1 million users, I'm like, okay, now we charge. And we automatically went from million free users to 50,000 paying users. But I always said that we were going to charge eventually. So immediately, at $199 a month, we were at $100,000 a month in revenues. Our burn was still $200,000, so we're still, or sorry, our cost were $200,000, so we're still losing $100,000 a month. But at least we had users, we had traffic, we had PR, because no company out there except for us was doing that type of volume. So I could go to conferences, you know, at CTIA, et cetera, and say, you know, we're downloading 100,000 ringtones this month. No one else could say that. And so even though we were a puny little company, we started having a level of credibility. Moreover, the publishing or the licensing business in the US is pretty complicated. And we started figuring out who owned what rights and getting all the rights. And so even though we're a small company, we were starting to get a little bit of traction. So I was knocking on the doors of all the carriers and all the media companies. At that time, I'd been talking to them for over a year, and no one had bid yet. So I had no contracts. We were still a direct-to-consumer play that wasn't really working because, you know, charging people by credit card is not a great model, especially when your consumers are teenagers and not have credit cards. Finally, I convinced Microsoft or MSN I buy a deal with Microsoft, essentially. So we do a revenue share deal, except the revenue sharing is so low. We weren't selling enough ringtones. So I said, look, I'm going to guarantee you $20,000 a month in revenues. So I basically bought a deal with Microsoft, paying them $20,000 a month. And that led to a fair amount of PR. And then one day, randomly, out of the blue, Motorola gives me a call. I'm like, hey, I see you have a deal with Microsoft. What is it you're doing? And I'm like, well, we sell ringtones. We have licenses. And they're like, hey, maybe we can take your top 25 and see if it works. So Motorola, at the time, the iDEN site, ran iDEN website for Nextel. So Motorola was selling the ringtones for Nextel. So do the deal with that guy, give him our top 25 songs. The next month, you know, those top 25 accounted for pretty much 50% of their sales. And like, oh my God, you know, why don't you run it for us? So within 3 months, we were running the entire site for them. Now, the thing is, those songs were hosted on their servers and they didn't have a real-time reporting system. So I had no clue how many of them I was selling. I had no clue how much revenues I was going to be generating. I didn't know anything. But that led to a similar deal with Sprint. Get a call from Sprint and they're like, hey, you know, the top 25 songs, especially in hip hop, they're really hard to license. They're owned by 25 different people. We're not getting the copyrights. Why don't you do it for us? I give them the top 25 songs. They put them up. A month later, it accounts for half of their sales. So they're like, hey, why don't you do all of their songs? You know, so by the mid 2003, we had Sprint, we had Motorola, which was running the site for Nextel, and we had MSN. We're getting traction, but I still didn't know what our revenues were, and we're still burning cash every month. It takes us to August 2003. So we had a really lean summer. I signed a few more deals. We signed AT&T. We signed Nextel. We signed MTV. We're working. So the contracts are signed, but we're not live yet. And we had no money. So I think we went down, you know, from 2015 employees, a few left. And finally, around August 15, 2003, the check from Sprint arrives. And the first check from Sprint is like $500,000. It's like, wow, you know, there is something after all. Ironically, the number 2 and 3 in the company at the time left the day the check arrived because they were, you know, they're somewhat older people that had families, et cetera, and they couldn't live with that payroll for that many months. And so the check from Sprint arrives, and I knew that day we were saved. You know, I pulled out the champagne. I'm like, you know, this is the beginning of the growth story. Now we're saved. We're cash flow. We're profitable. We're cash flow positive. Repay the debt, pay payroll, and we're going to grow the company. August 23, we launch an AT&T wireless. And this time, we are directly connected in the billing system of AT&T. And day one, $5,000 in revenues. Day two, $7,000. You know, within 4 months, we were like $20,000 a day on just AT&T. Then October 1 of 2003, we launched an MTV and Virgin Mobile. Again, day one, you know, $10,000 in sales, $15,000 in sales. October 15, we launched with Nextel. And again, this time, we take over the entire Nextel website. And boom, that goes through the roof. October 19, we launched AOL. And then the next few months after that, it was launching every single carrier in the U.S. So we went from like no carriers to 14 carriers in the U.S., all 4 carriers in Canada, 4 carriers in Latin America in like a year. You know, our revenues went from $100,000 a month to over, you know, $4 million a month in a period of like 12 months, essentially 24 months. It was incredible. So when that started happening, actually all of a sudden a lot of the VCs became interested in like, hey, you know, this is an interesting company. Why don't we fund you? The thing is, by then we started generating, you know, $1 million in profits a month. You know, so all of a sudden after a few months, we had like $4 or $5 million in the bank. I didn't even know what to do with the money. So I wasn't sure. I hesitated for a while. And as we kept hesitating and the company kept growing, so it was also in my interest to play it slow. We got a few acquisition offers. I almost said yes to selling the company in September 2003 for $8 million. You know, and I had 53% of the company, so it was hard to say no because I've been so close to losing everything. And, you know, I missed paying rent for 4 months. It was close.
So again, you're sitting on a lot of money, but you're not worth a lot personally.
Exactly. I was like, maybe I'm worth a lot, but, you know, I still have no money in my bank account.
Yeah, I was like not as bad as Lycos, but that same dynamic.
Exactly. And you know, then someone offers 12, well, then 10, then 12, then 15, then 20. And then I'm like, you know what? Stop this. We're not fundraising. We're just growing the company. Let's not even think of selling. Let's just go for it. Let's build it. We build the company. We sign all the carriers we hadn't signed. We sign all the media companies we hadn't signed. We started launching new products. So, you know, from monophonic ringtones, we go to polyphonic ringtones. From black and white wallpapers, we go to color wallpapers. We started working on licensing ringbacks, doing exclusive deals with artists. So we really grow the product portfolio. We really start scaling the company. You know, we move 4 times to bigger offices. We just keep growing. And the revenues keep growing. The profits keep growing. And then in April 2004, get approached by a Japanese company that I've been working on working with for a few months, maybe 6 to 9 months. And out of the blue, they say, we want to buy you $40 million cash now. So that made me think twice. I'm like, wow, you know, now we're starting to speak about numbers, multiples that you need to consider really whether or not the company's worth that much and will ever be worth that much. And I'm like, okay. It's interesting enough, and maybe they can bring me geographic diversification and product diversification. Maybe there's something there. So I hire an investment bank, which, by the way, I recommend everyone to do if you're ever going to sell your company and it's worth more than 20, 30 million, because then the investment bank can be the bad guy. You know, it's the greedy investment bankers that want to increase the price, and they're really difficult negotiating, and you come in and you save them. Because the last thing you want to do is create a negative conflict-ridden relationship with your potential acquirers, because you're going to have to work with them after they buy you. And so I hired the investment banks. They go around the world, try to find all these different buyers, and they create an auction process. And we finally signed a term sheet to sell the company for $80 million in cash to the – actually ended up selling it to the first bidder, which was the Japanese company.
So that's twice as much as the original offer.
That's twice as much as the original offer. So
you said you'd own 52%?
53% or so, yeah.
All right, yeah. That's a cool 40 to walk away with.
Yeah, after tax, a bit less than that. But yes, it's decent. So I wasn't sure I was going to sell there even then. I was like, okay, do we raise more money? Because I had private equity money companies say, hey, we'll give you $80 million valuation. We'll put money in your pocket. We'll put money in the bank account. Or you sell. Or I could sell for $80 million completely.
Now this sale, all cash, no more equity for you?
All cash, no more equity. Well, 40 up front, the rest in earn out. But no more equity. So I considered for a while, and at the time, we had very little of visibility. You know, Q1 of 04, we probably did $4 million in revenues, maybe a bit less than that, and $1 million in profits. So I'm like, okay, so Q1 04, we do that. You know, what's a reasonable number to expect for all of 04? I'm like, yeah, maybe $20 million revenues, $4 million profits, $3 million profits. And so based on that, $80 million valuation, it's very, very rich. It's very reasonable. You know, it's 20 times PE. You know, it's 4 times revenues. It's worth selling. So I sell the company and blow out all of the numbers that we'd ever expected to blow. You know, we ended up doing in product sales probably 45, 50 million in product sales last year, you know, growing to 130 million this year. So obviously the earnout objectives were all achieved and exceeded by a lot. And that's why I stayed. I stayed because it was a lot of fun and I thought I could grow the company to the next level. And it has been a lot of fun to take it to this level, prepare to go public, do SOX compliance, hire a CFO, and really get it in order. But we acquired another company, which was called Vinigo, which was an information services company to diversify our product offering. We started getting into the games business by doing game. We obtained the 50 cent or G unit gaming license. So we structured the company, we scaled it up, we diversified product offerings.
So you stayed on your CEO still?
I stayed on as CEO for about 18 months. 12 of which actually I didn't need to. I mean, 6 months ago, my employment agreement expired, my earnout was paid, or at least was earned. But I like, you know, it was fun. So in hindsight, I might have made a mistake because if I had taken the private equity money and grown the business, I would have ended up doing financially a lot better. The reason I sold is Zingy actually violated one of my famous 9 business selection criteria. One of my 9 business selection criteria is do not be in a business where there's a risk of margin compression or disintermediation by your suppliers and or your customers. Now, Zingy, there's a risk of both of margin compression and or disintermediation on both sides, because the top three carriers in the U.S., which do all of our billing and therefore account for 99% of our revenues, and the top music labels and content companies in the U.S. account for most of our costs. And so there's a risk that they might go direct to each other, might want to get into our business. And it's never good to be a little guy between huge giants. At least it's okay if you're a little guy, but once you become a mid-sized guy like we are, it gets a bit more dangerous. In May 2004, when I considered, do I raise money or do I sell, I was feeling the squeeze. You know, I'd received a letter from AT&T saying, you know, the rev share used to be 80-20, 80 for me, 20 for them. Now it's 60-40, take it or leave it. You know, at the same time, I was getting labels saying, hey, we're going to go in the business directly. And I sprint and said, you know, maybe we're going to do this on our own. So I was feeling a bit pessimistic. So I'm like, okay, take some money off the table, put money on the side. You know, next business, I'll grow to a billion. I won't need to sell. And so I sold. 2020 hindsight, everything we did to fight that from happening succeeded. You know, we did direct relationships with artists. We signed more carriers and further revenue streams. We started doing more and more for the carriers, and therefore they realized we had value to bring. We started building direct consumer channel. Everything we did worked well and much better than I expected it to. And as a result, maybe selling was not the right choice. But with the information I had at the time, it was the right choice. So definitely no regrets. So I did that for the past 18 months. And now I've kind of realized, you know, I've probably taken this company not as far as it can go, but as far as it can go in light of what the current shareholder or who the current shareholders are. So I'm owned by a publicly traded company that's extremely valuable and is pretty rich PE. And as a result, our interests are slightly different. You know, I want to grow a multi-billion dollar company. And I think the way to do that today would be to invest more into direct consumer marketing, to invest more in diversifying the product portfolio, to invest more in getting more exclusive and original licenses, and probably decreasing the profitability. But their interest is maximizing the short-term profitability to maximize the market cap. And therefore, ambitions are slightly or somewhat divergent, because I don't think, as a result, that I will be in a position at Zingy to build a multi-billion dollar company. I mean, they may yet do it their own way. And so I'm like, you know, I've seen this company where I can take it. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to grow and build a new company. And so quit Zingy yesterday and resigned my position as CEO and, you know,
decided. See the box on your desk here?
Exactly. I have all boxes in the desk. So I'm actually moving everything out from my office tomorrow and going on vacation after tomorrow.
That way too.
Basically, traveling around the world. I'm going to Paris to see my friends, whom I have not seen in years, for a few days. I'm going to London.
Now, are you really going to hang out with your friends, or are you seeing what they're doing in Europe and thinking of ideas?
You can do a bit of both. But definitely, I'm keeping my eyes open for the next big idea that I'm going to invest in. In fact, I'm invested in a few companies, and I'm going to help, I'm going to see if their partnerships can be done, et cetera. So, and a lot of my friends are entrepreneurs, so it's always good to see what they're up to, or maybe ideas they have, or if they can be hired for the next big thing. So I'm going to Paris for a few days, then I'm going to London for a few days, then I'm going to Verbier in Switzerland to go skiing, and that's a real vacation. Then I'm going to Morocco for a week, and again, real vacation. Then I'm going to see my family in Nice, which is where I grew up. And then I'm going to Argentina for 2 weeks. Half vacation, half work, because the Derimate team is in Argentina, and we just sold Derimate again, you know, this time away from Terra Lycos into a newspaper company called La Nación, which then flipped it to another company called Mercado Libre, which is 20% owned by eBay. And that team is now, you know, free to, or at least part of the team is now free to pursue other alternatives and ideas, and I have, I think, just an idea for them. And then I'll be back in the U.S. in the mid-late January to figure out what I'm going to do next, but all I can tell you is it's going to be entrepreneurial in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, you're not going back to McKinsey anytime soon.
Oh no, my God! I love McKinsey and I love the people I work with there, but you know, I can't work for someone. I'd rather, well, I could work. I can have shareholders, but I'd rather be laying the vision and building a company and growing it. So I'm an entrepreneur and I'm going to remain an entrepreneur.
Great. And let me just also just kind of go back and touch on your style as an entrepreneur. If someone's listening, it sounds as though everything you're doing is very focused on money and kind of all business. I don't know about that, but you know, very much all business. But walking around here in the office, I see very eclectic mix of people wearing jeans. You got, you know, what's like, how would you describe your style?
Driven, ambitious, and passionate. But at the same time, it doesn't mean you can't have fun. I mean, you succeed a lot better if you do something that you like. If you like the work you're doing, if you like the business you're in, if you like the people you work with. mean, we have a foosball table here. I actually won the foosball tournament. I love foosball. I love hanging out with the employees here and playing ping pong or just talking, playing video games. And so, you know, while I am ambitious, driven, et cetera, the objective at the end of the day is to have fun and build a great business and company together and meet lots of interesting people and grow with them. No, it's not all about money. I want to create a business that's successful, but the objective is not to make money. In fact, most people that build businesses to make money end up losing because they're not willing to sacrifice at all. They're not willing to, you know, borrow $100,000 on a credit card and work for no salary for 4 years and maybe go bankrupt. Whereas, you know, nothing has changed in my life. I still live in the same apartment I lived in 4 years ago. It's fun. I mean, we do this because it's fun. And the reason, by the way, that people are so eclectic is different roles for different businesses, right? We're in the media industry. So in the content team at Zingy, they have to be cool. They have to go to the clubs. They have to be musicians. They have to be in the know and in touch with the entertainment industry and go out with, you know, Fitty and Eminem, et cetera. But we also have the programmers and they need to be developing the best software. And we have all the business people and the HR and admin people. So basically, not sure what my style is. It's fairly decentralized. So we have a strong COO, strong CFO, strong CTO. We have good VPs across the organization. So I lay out the strategy. I pursue the important deals and important priority setting. But at the end of the day,
so that's where you are now. So what's, do you have anything cooking? Any inklings? What next business you want to go into? Next industry?
Well, most likely it'll meet my 9 business selection criteria. It's most likely going to be consumer oriented. It's most likely going to be intranet services, and maybe media oriented, but because these are my interests and companies that meet a lot of my interests. It might also be a marketplace just because I like marketplaces as a concept. Always love the eBay model, and the eBay model has been declined many declinations, you know, Match.com, Jobs, et cetera. And I think it still has a lot of legs to it.
You don't think we're in 96 again, where all the ideas have been taken?
We're at the very beginning of the internet revolution. I mean, not all the good ideas have been taken. If you think back, right, in 96, people said, ooh, all the good ideas are taken. And yet, now that you have broadband, you're seeing, you know, things like iTunes that couldn't have existed before, things like, you know, podcasting, blogging, all these new things are coming up all the time. The internet is at the very beginning. As soon, you know, broadband is continuing to explode from a bandwidth and penetration perspective. The devices are becoming only more powerful. The experiences, the opportunities, and the services that are going to be available are, we can't even begin to imagine today. We're at the beginning of a, you know, 100-year revolution. Moreover, the internet is going to become more, not necessarily transparent, but it's going to go in the background. I think a lot of the devices and service that we buy today, you know, from a fridge to whatever, are going to all be internet connected, and we're just going to not know. It's just one feature amongst many. There's a lot to do. And a lot to be done in this country and other countries as well.
Well, Fabrice, thanks for coming on and good luck doing it. But in the meantime, enjoy your vacation.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed our interview today with Fabrice. Fabrice's style just goes to show how many ways there are to approach being an entrepreneur. But it's worth looking at what he did to think about what kind of process there is for starting a company and if there is a process for being an entrepreneur. Something to ponder, but we're going to keep tracking down new entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and other people involved in the startup world to bring to you and share their wisdom. If you have any comments, thoughts, complaints, anything at all, just pop onto our website, venturevoice.com, where you can find show notes, all the links mentioned in this show. And by the way, Fabrice just launched a great blog with a lot of his insights broken down. We're going to link to that from the website too, so be sure to check it out. You can leave comments on the website to give your thoughts on this show. You can also send us an email directly by emailing talk@venturevoice.com. Till next time, I'm your host Greg Gallant with Venture Voice, entertaining entrepreneurship.